Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and from the law firm of Primer, Piper, Eggleston, and Kramer, providing comprehensive legal counsel to New Hampshire businesses and their owners for more than 30 years. For more information or to speak to an attorney, visit primer.com. And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. What's next for hydropower in New England after the New Hampshire Supreme Court gave a firm and final no to Northern Pass? The project was supposed to bring Canadian hydropower down through New Hampshire and onto the New England grid, but transmission proved an insurmountable obstacle for communities along the power line's pathway. And so, after almost 10 years of effort and a ton of money, the project's backer, Eversource, is evaluating its next steps. And Eversource isn't alone. Other companies and New England states with hydropower hopes are looking at what happened in New Hampshire and whether they need to adjust their own plans. Today in The Exchange, regional ripples from the Northern Pass failure. What's next for the Granite State and its neighbors? Let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Joining us from Connecticut is John Dankowski. He's executive editor of the New England News Collaborative and host of Next, a weekly radio show and podcast about New England, produced by Connecticut Public Radio in Hartford. And John, welcome back. Nice to have you.
Good to be here, Laura.
Also with us in studio, Sam Evans Brown, host of NHPR's podcast Outside In, longtime environment reporter. By the way, you can check out Sam's award-winning series on hydropower called Power Lines on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. And Sam, thank you so much. You're always helping us out. We appreciate it.
Happy to be here.
So how surprising was this, Sam, that the state Supreme Court unanimously rejected Northern Pass's appeal?
I think it depends whose chair you're sitting in. Certainly the developer, Eversource, was quite surprised. I think they're rather accustomed to getting their projects approved. And in fact, most projects that go through the Site Evaluation Committee have been approved. There's only been one previously that's been rejected, which was a wind farm a number of years ago. And actually, it managed to get reconfigured and then accepted. So ultimately, it still did get through. So there have been very few projects that have been denied by the Site Evaluation Committee. But then the question is, once the denial has come, how likely is it that the state Supreme Court will overturn that denial? And I think that most watchers of administrative law would tell you that the Supreme Court is very unlikely to step in a matter where you have allegedly expert bureaucrats making a decision on a complicated subject matter. The only way that you can get it overturned is if they've failed to do their duty as a matter of law, not as a matter of on the merits of the project. And so when you looked at Northern Pass's argument, they were essentially arguing that on the merits they should have been accepted, and the Supreme Court unanimously said, we don't want to go there.
So were you surprised? You're someone who's been following Northern Pass for a long time.
It's a funny question, because I think if you were to have pinned me down in the corner of a bar where no one could have heard me, I might have given my opinion on the matter before the decision. I mean, I personally thought that it was unlikely that the Supreme Court was going to overturn the subject matter experts on the Site Evaluation Committee. But you never know. I mean, the Supreme Court, courts generally are kind of a wild card, and pre-deciding, trying to prejudge what they're going to do is dangerous territory. So I will say, no, I wasn't surprised, but I probably wouldn't have told you that beforehand.
Well, John, from a New England perspective, were you surprised, or what are people around the region saying about this decision? It's got ripple effects, which we're going to talk about.
Well, yeah, I think that the main thing for us watching from outside of New Hampshire, not understanding the internal politics of New Hampshire or the Supreme Court decision, I think we see a project that had been doomed for quite some time because of a lack of popular opinion. When I was thinking back about projects that I've seen go, like Northern Pass, I think about the Broadwater project in Long Island Sound. It was a liquefied natural gas terminal that was proposed to sit between New York and Connecticut. It encountered enormous opposition from grassroots groups and increasingly from politicians. And after a while, it just never stood a chance. I know Sam has followed closely some of the developments of offshore wind over the course of the last couple decades. And the Cape Wind project, which had so much promise for the possibility of being the first big offshore wind farm in America, but it just couldn't get past the enormous political and personal opposition of people who lived there. And so from the outside, I see Northern Pass as something that for a long time seems to have been doomed, not by any legal reason, not by any procedural reason, but by the fact that seemingly a large number of people in that state just didn't want it to happen.
Well, and let's look back just briefly, gentlemen, about why this project failed after almost 10 years. It seems unbelievable to even say that. Lots of business support, lots of union support, tons of money. What happened, Sam?
Well, so it very quickly generated grassroots backlash in the communities that were going to play host to the project. And if you think back to the announcement, I was thinking about this the other day. So this project was announced the spring that I began as a reporter at NHPR. So spring of, I think it was
2010?
Spring of 2011.
2011, okay.
I could be wrong about that. I mean, the memory fades, right? but Governor Lynch, who was this sort of, he was the type of governor who rarely took positions on controversial items, was at the announcement of this grand project that was going to, you know, mean development and tax revenue for the city of Franklin, that was going to host the terminal where it was the power switch from DC to AC, and there was this grand announcement, and then as soon as the backlash came, he sort of melted into the wallpaper, right? He was never seen supporting the project again, and I think that just goes to show you that when it was imagined, it was thought to be something that was just going to sail through, but very quickly, especially in the North Country, opponents emerged. The Society for the Protection of New Hampshire Forests marshaled large amounts of money to sort of purchase a blockade of conserved land that required Northern Pass to reconfigure its route. It became clear that there were concerns about whether the White Mountain National Forest was going to approve the project, and they essentially had a veto over whether or not it was going to get built, and so the route had to be reconfigured again. And so it really just dragged out, and I think the amount of time that the opponents were able to buy meant that the project just sort of languished, and the opposition was able to grow and cement itself. If you look at the Site Evaluation Committee, from the point where the project was proposed to when it was considered, the law governing the Site Evaluation Committee was rewritten in that span. So the ground sort of shifted underneath the developers because the project sat for so long. So it just dragged out.
We asked Eversource to join us today, but given the tornado on Cape Cod, they said they were in emergency mode. They were unable to be with us. However, just after the Supreme Court's decision late last week, NHPR's Annie Ropeek got Eversource spokesman William Hinkle on the phone.
Northern Pass was the most advanced project to bring abundant, low-cost, clean energy into the region. This is an unfortunate setback to our efforts to advance affordable, clean energy in the state.
We also reached out to the New Hampshire Business and Industry Association. President Jim Roach sent us this statement, and I won't read the whole thing, but there's a couple points in here that I'd like to run by you, gentlemen. Jim Roach says, the New Hampshire Supreme Court's decision is both surprising and unfortunate. As nonprofit electric grid regulator ISO New England warned last year, the region's power system will soon be unable to meet electricity demand and maintain reliability without some degree of emergency actions. And Mr. Roach mentions rolling blackouts, controlled outages, quoting ISO there. He says that would be devastating not just to residential customers, but employers, healthcare providers, manufacturers, hotels, banks, and all manner of commerce. There is no question, he says, that green options such as wind and solar should be part of our energy mix, but their volatility and high cost mean that we need more 24/7 baseload energy in the short term. And Northern Pass, Roach says, was exactly that. So, Sam, to you first, but John, jump in. Yes, there was this grassroots opposition. We all remember the rallies and the orange T-shirts, and I go up to the North Country a lot, and the signs are still there. But there was considerable support also for this project.
Yes, yeah, so specifically from any large power consumer in New England is concerned about the energy prices in the state. New England has when you look at retail power costs, we have some of the highest in the nation. I mean, we're typically in the Northeast behind only Alaska and Hawaii in terms of energy rates in the United States. And so anything that will depress those rates tends to get support from the business community. The question then becomes, you know, why was it that they weren't able to get this project through? And when you look at the Supreme Court decision, essentially what the justices say is that Northern Pass just did a bad job of presenting its case. They said the experts weren't convincing, that the regulators were unable to determine from the record whether or not there was going to be an adverse impact, so they didn't even know how to propose mitigation to deal with the impact. And I think what this goes to show is that there's been a paradigm for a long time that utilities have operated under, where they go behind closed doors, they decide what a project is going to look like, they announce what the project is going to be, and they defend it to the hilt. And that
model just didn't work this time.
Yeah, and I think that there's a number of reasons why it doesn't work. I think, you know, community members are getting a little savvier in terms of navigating these projects and knowing how the levers of bureaucracies work in order to fight against them. I also think that the rules have been rewritten to be more inclusive of community support, community input. And so that model is falling by the wayside. And if you look around the country, projects that are getting built are ones that invite the public in earlier to provide feedback as to what they want a project to look like before the final, you know, route is announced and you know the lawyers have to defend it in court.
Yeah, so we're really seeing a shift, Sam, in how, you know, companies present these projects because people feel like they deserve to have a say. They deserve some political power in this process. Go ahead, John.
No, I also just jump in and say that I think part of the reason, though, the message is muddled is that if a project like Northern Pass was simply meant to solve our energy needs, to drive down costs for businesses in New Hampshire specifically, then that would be a message that maybe more people could get behind. But a large reason why this was being built was to get power not to New Hampshire businesses and New Hampshire residents, but to get power to the power-hungry folks in the growing greater Boston area of Massachusetts. And the real reason that Massachusetts stepped in and wanted to buy power in this way is because they're trying to deal with a greenhouse gas problem. So it's as though we are trying to solve a lot of problems at once with a project like this, drive down costs, make sure the peak demand is met, and also solve for some of our renewable energy needs. And with all those competing interests in some ways happening at the same time, I don't know, Sam, but it feels as though it's hard to message something in exactly the way that's going to get a large constituency behind it.
Well, and you're raising something really interesting that I want to ask you about, John, this sort of north-south tension. A lot of times Northern Pass opponents said, why should New Hampshire be, you know, the electrical cord for people in Connecticut and Massachusetts to crank their air conditioners? So there was that kind of tension about, is this power really for us?
Yeah, the states of Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Rhode Island over the course of the last few years have put out a number of proposals trying to procure energy from different sources, and that energy is often going to come from places not cited in those three states. It's more cost efficient, they say, to find a way to get power down from Hydro-Québec, where, as Sam well knows, there's an awful lot of excess power, or to buy power from offshore wind farms or new wind farms that are up in the northern parts of New England that have a lot more available wind energy. Connecticut, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island are growing in their power consumption, and I think that's something that's not going to stop anytime soon. The state where I live has almost no ability to generate renewable energy itself. It's a very congested state, not a lot of places to put solar arrays. hardly any available wind energy. We're not going to put any turbines in Long Island Sound. And so Connecticut's going to be looking elsewhere for its power, which includes how are we going to get power down from Hydro-Québec? How are we going to get natural gas in from Pennsylvania? How are we going to find energy other ways?
Well, I want to ask both of you what Hydro-Québec does now, because my understanding is it has excess power. But let's go to our listeners as well. Today on The Exchange, we're talking about the defeat of Northern Pass just last week. What happened and what's next for hydropower in New England? There are ripple effects across the region from this rejection by New Hampshire's state Supreme Court. The number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477, or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Sam and John, let's go to the phones. And Tim is calling from Portsmouth. Hi, Tim. You're on the air. Welcome.
Oh, good morning, Laura, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I've actually called before the last time you discussed Northern Pass. A little background. I'm 67. I've lived in New Hampshire all my life. I live in Mount Vernon, although I'm calling from Portsmouth today because I work over here in Portsmouth because that's where the money is. In any event, I am a certified tree hugger. There are actual photographs of me hugging trees, number one. Number two, my wife and I spend a tremendous amount of time in the woods of New Hampshire. I am fond of trees, and I'm fond of the woods in New Hampshire.
So how about Northern Pass, Tim?
I am fond of any type of energy that's not created by burning fossil fuels. So I have to tell you, I just see a massive hypocrisy on the part of every environmentalist I know about Northern Pass, because I don't care if the power goes to Connecticut or wherever the power goes. It's a regional power grid, and the power goes wherever it's needed. We're all in this ship together, and right now we're burning our ship. We're burning our environment. We're burning our planet, and anytime we can avoid a little bit of the burning, that's a good thing in my book, and
I'm
adamant about it.
Thank you for calling.
I'm so disappointed.
Send us a picture by email of you hugging a tree, because I would love to see that. That'd be really fun. And I appreciate his comment on a regional power grid. But what about his criticism, Sam Evans Brown, about environmental groups and their role in this? And by the way, after a break, we're going to talk to the Conservation Law Foundation. But go ahead. What role did environmental groups play?
So it'll be interesting to hear from the Conservation Law Foundation, because I think that they, in particular, are a group that sort of exemplifies how this is a complicated path for them to walk. Because CLF opposed this project and came out with some, I would say, over-the-top rhetoric, in particular about the greenhouse gas emissions of hydropower reservoirs in Quebec, for instance, that perhaps mischaracterized the science, I'd say, early on. But now that there's another project in Maine that they like the look of a little better, they're supporting that project. And so I have heard there certainly are folks who are in the environmental movement who don't like large-scale hydropower. They don't like the idea of these huge transmission lines connecting us to remote power sources. But there are many who would say, listen, I'm okay with connecting to Hydro-Québec, especially if they're just using surplus power on existing dams, which Hydro-Québec argues is somewhat the case. But I just didn't like the route of this exact power line, and that there are less impactful routes for a power line. So you get the full spectrum, right? You get the folks who hate hydro in any way, shape, or form.
We should not support it ever, ever.
Right. You get the folks who think, like, no matter what the cost, climate change is too serious, I will support this project.
People like Tim.
And then you get the qualified yes from folks like the Conservation Law Foundation, who just say, I didn't like the root of this line.
All right. There's a lot more to talk about in just a moment. And as I said, we will be talking to the Conservation Law Foundation more after a short break. This is The Exchange on NHPR. Let's check in now with our summer car raffle.
My initial reaction was disbelief.
My name is Peter Hogue Jr.
It's Maggie Kirkhoff from Hollis, New Hampshire.
Chip Krause from Manchester, New Hampshire.
My name is Greta Johansson.
I'm the car raffle winner from 2011.
2009.
2018.
The 2010.
2017 summer car raffle.
I actually bought the raffle ticket. I waited to the last hour and decided to do it.
And I didn't anticipate winning anything. I just figured I was donating, and then one Saturday, I got a phone call from NHPR, and
my instinct told me
that it was the car.
Of course, whoever believes they're going to win the prize after they buy their tickets for anything, for any raffle.
Either way, I just was giving money to public radio.
It's a win-win, folks. It's a win-win on NHPR during our summer car raffle. I'm Nick Cappadice, delighted to be in the studio with my friend and colleague, Taylor Quimby.
Hello.
Hello. So the exchange is going to come up in a moment. As you've been hearing, we've been doing, we've been covering Northern Pass, a very interesting decision by the New Hampshire Supreme Court denying the continuation of the Northern Pass project. Sam Evans Brown.
He's been following this for so long.
So long. Sam and Hannah McCarthy, together worked on a four-part series called Powerline. In-depth, amazing reporting on the Northern Pass project. That's the sort of work you're supporting, but also shows like The Exchange. And the fun thing is you may get a new car. So you got to go to nhpr.org to do it, and Taylor's going to tell you how it works.
It's really, really easy to do on the website. You're going to find all the directions there. You can also give somebody a call at 1-888-805-6477. Here's the basics. The tickets are $50 a piece, but they get cheaper the more you get. So six tickets for just $150. And as you keep going, they get cheaper and cheaper. So you can get 35 tickets for $500. It's a great deal.
Bargain.
What you get is a chance to win $25,000 towards a brand new car or truck of your choice. This is the very public radio DIY sort of car raffle. You get to pick the car for you, but you've got to be in it to win it. And you go to nhpr.org to get your tickets.
And there's a lot more you can win besides just the car. You
oh, know, I'm skipping
you,
stuff, aren't
oh,
I?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, no, that's okay. You could win the kayak. We're giving away a kayak. It's a Liquid Logic 13.5-foot long kayak. I'm going to steal a line from Josh Rogers. He says it had a paddle, a life vest, and a safety course. The only thing it's missing is a pilot. If you want to be paddling down the Kakamangas?
The Kank.
If you want to be paddling down
the road.
Well, there's a river as well, I thought. Oh, you want to be paddling down the Pemigewasset. The best way to do it is in this bluff, well-turning kayak. Got to go to nhpr.org and buy yourself a ticket.
And the big question, I think, is, you know, how much should you give to public radio? How many tickets should you buy? You know, you can think of it as the number of chances, maybe, that you want to throw in the hat for any of these great prizes. You could also think about it as, how much do you care about public radio? How much does Laura's show, The Exchange, really mean to you? Mm. How much does it guide you in the morning, give you something to talk about throughout your day, give you something to think about when you're having supper at night and discuss with your partner or your kids? It's such a great program, and there are so many great programs like this. Chances are, if you really calculate how much public radio means to you, you're going to realize it means a lot. So, you know, put that into raffle tickets. Maybe that's six for 150. Maybe it's nine for 200. Whatever it is, you're supporting the public radio that you really, really love and care about. So get your tickets now at nhpr.org.
Yeah, The Exchange is a tremendous show. It's New Hampshire, far and away, New Hampshire's largest call-in show.
People oh, yeah.
From all across the state call and talk to Laura and to Peter about what's going on in New Hampshire. I am a devotee of political news, what's going on in D.C. But if I want to know what really affects my life, I have to listen to The Exchange to get it. Every single day, it's a new topic. I have no idea how they do it. Taylor, do you think you could pull that? I don't know how they do it.
It is hard. I mean, you just think that it's been on for, what, 20, 25 plus years.
Yeah.
That is a lot of shows.
It's a lot of topics. It's a lot of shows. Today, we're talking about Northern Pass. We had a conversation about single-use plastics. We did an outside-in on the Pine Barrens. I mean, this is the sort of stuff that's local and it matters to you. Support that work. Buy a ticket. Win a car. Get some, get some stuff. NHPR.org. And thanks so much for tuning in during the raffle.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest and You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, the defeat of Northern Pass, what happened, and what it means for other hydropower projects in New England. Let's hear from you. Call in 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or use Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. My guest for the hour, John Dankofsky, executive editor of the New England News Collaborative and host of Next, a weekly radio show and podcast about New England. And with me in studio, Sam Evans Brown, host of NHPR's podcast Outside In and longtime environment reporter. And gentlemen, back to our listeners. And here's an email from Cara in New London who says, I'm confused I did a paper on Northern Pass for a class a couple of years ago. At the time, I believe it was the U.S. Department of Energy that had charts and data you could pull on energy use in every state. I thought we exported energy to other states already, so how could bringing more power in possibly lower costs? It doesn't seem like the excuse holds water. And Kara, thank you so much for the email. And Sam and John, Sam, you first. This is an important point because our earlier caller, Tim, was right. We are operating under a regional power grid here in New England, but I don't know if people really understand what that means.
Yeah, so the way that the markets are set up, it's sort of delegated down from the federal level, and each market is established in a regional context. And in New England, ISO New England is the organization, the Independent System Operator of New England is the organization that operates the markets. And that includes all of the New England states. So the idea that New Hampshire generates more electricity than it uses doesn't really matter because it's selling into this New England market.
And it's so like putting water into a bathtub.
Yeah, exactly. And so the fact that New Hampshire generates more than it uses really has very minimal effect on the power prices in New Hampshire itself, because those prices are created regionally in this regional market.
So why is that point so often made? You know, we were talking with John earlier about how people said, why should we approve Northern Pass? It's just an electric cord going down to Massachusetts and Connecticut. Why is this state-by-state argument made when the power is produced regionally?
Really, it just scores rhetorical points. I mean, it sounds good, and also there is a certain truth that there are regions that have more demand, and there are states that have more supply. That is not in of itself untrue. It's just sort of beside the point. So the question is, okay, so given the market realities that prices are formed at this regional level, the question is then, what do you do with that information? And it really comes down to, if you want to drive down costs, you have to bring in more supply. And that is what a project like Northern Pass would do. Now it is just a single project, right? It was 1 gigawatt in a system that uses at its peak 28 gigawatts. So the idea that it would have a massive effect on power prices by bringing in, you know, 1 gigawatt of marginally lower price supply is not quite true. It would have a small effect on regional power prices. So the writer-inner is in fact both sort of right and wrong, that it wouldn't have a huge effect, but it would have some effect.
Well, and John, so we talked about this a little bit before the break. What does Hydro-Québec do now with the excess power that it says it still has?
Well, one of the things that they're going to try to do, at least to get it to Massachusetts, is send it down through Maine. Central Maine Power has had a project going, not for quite as long as Northern Pass, called New England Clean Energy Connect, and it would run about 150 miles down from the border with Canada down to Lewiston, where it would hook up with the rest of the energy grid. And it's going to go through, much like it would have in New Hampshire, an environmentally sensitive wooded area. I think it's fair to say a few things. This project from the outset was going to be a less costly endeavor than Northern Pass. It also had more of the necessary permitting in place already by the time Massachusetts decided to move from Northern Pass over to this main project to get its power. So it had those things going for it. And as you said before, some environmentalists at least have lined up behind this project, saying that this is actually a good solution, as opposed to CLF and others ending up on the other side of the ledger for Northern Pass. So right now the CMP project is moving forward, and it's starting to, Laura, I think, encounter some of the same types of pushback that was happening in New Hampshire, but it's just not coming from, let's just say, as many official sources as you had lining up against the project in your state.
CMP, again, is Central Maine Power, right, John?
Yeah, Central Maine Power. And so, you know, another piece to this, which is, I think, not unimportant, is that Central Maine Power is a local power company for the state of Maine. Eversource is a big multi-state utility which serves customers in my state, in Connecticut, in Massachusetts, in New Hampshire. It has a whole lot of political connections, and I think it's fair to say that some people were skeptical of the political connections that it had with the State House in New Hampshire and the State House in Boston, and how wired up Eversource was to try to get their project through. Central Maine Power is a Maine concern, and so they're trying to at least put forward the notion that this is a project that will benefit Maine and Mainers along the way and not just be that extension cord that gets the power down to Boston.
So, Sam, same question. What does Hydro-Québec do now?
Yeah, so Hydro-Québec has said, so they're still damming rivers up in Quebec. Currently, as we speak, the Romaine River, which is, you know, a good 13-hour drive northeast of Montreal, is in process of being dammed. They're putting up four new power stations on that river. Three are completed. One is underway. So in addition to those new dams that are going up, they already have a surplus.
They see a future in this.
Yeah. Well, if you look at the history of Hydro-Québec, it is it's owned by the province. The province of Quebec has 100% of the share of the company, and it was created explicitly to generate surplus power to sell to out other regions. New York City has always been a big customer for them, and New England as well. So that's a very explicit strategy. They're actually trying to double their revenue over the next 15 years, and very explicitly in their plan, it says exports is a big way of how we're going to do this. So they envision building this power line and probably another two. So there's another line being built down right now that is going underwater. It's a buried line going to New York City. It's called the Champlain-Hudson Express. They're building that. In theory, if it gets through regulators in Maine, they'll build the line through Maine. But it's a little hard to know because Hydro-Québec is a bit of a black box. We don't know what the reservoir levels are. We don't know how many gallons of water are behind the dam because that's sort of market sensitive information. But they have said that they have enough surplus to power three transmission lines. So there could be another power line that gets built to New England or to New York in order to satisfy this long term plan of Hydro-Québec of doubling their revenue by selling surplus to the expensive power markets of the Northeast.
Well, there's a lot more about Hydro-Québec, how it works, the history in Sam's excellent award-winning series called Powerline. We've got a link on our website if you haven't heard it, nhpr.org/exchange. Gentlemen, I want to bring another voice into our conversation now. Melissa Burchard is with us, senior attorney for the Conservation Law Foundation in Concord. And Melissa, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
So what do you think the rejection of Northern Pass here in New Hampshire says about hydropower's future in New Hampshire?
Honestly, hydropower has a big future in the region. It's already played a significant role in the region and will continue to play a significant role in the region. As you guys have discussed already on the show, the region has a shared power grid, and New Hampshire relies on that shared power grid. In terms of what projects can be developed in New Hampshire, transmission developing companies need to take a close look at their approach to bringing forward projects. And I think Sam Evans-Brown got it right when he talked earlier about the fact that project developers are starting to learn the lesson that you don't come into a community, you don't come into New Hampshire and wave your hands around and make loud noises like the Wizard of Oz, because if you do that, we're gonna pull back that screen and we're gonna see that behind the hand waving is a poorly considered project that's just not honest about its impact. And anytime you have one of these large hydroelectric projects that is accompanied by a large transmission line, it's going to have a significant impact on habitat, on the environment, on communities. You can't avoid that. What you need to do is to be honest about it, to work with communities, and to mitigate the impacts.
So your problem wasn't so much with hydro itself. When I say you, I mean CLF, Melissa. It was more the way this project was mapped out.
Yeah, what Sam Evans-Brown mentioned a little bit earlier, that CLF talked about the environmental impacts of the Northern Pass project early on. And what Northern Pass was doing, what Eversource and Northern Pass were doing early on, were saying, you know, there are no impacts. This is all perfect. This is all green. And that's really a line they stuck with throughout the project development process. And so when when the project got to the site evaluation committee, the site evaluation committee said, that's just not realistic. That's just not right. You've provided inadequate evidence because you're sticking to this line that there really aren't any impacts. How can we work with that? And that's what New Hampshire community said, too. How can we work with a project developer who's just not going to be honest and to alleviate the impacts? That's really one of the major issues with Northern Pass. This project would have had really significant impacts on habitat, the environment, communities, and project developers like Eversource and Northern Pass need to be better partners if they're going to be successful.
CLF does support the project in Maine that John Denkovsky mentioned earlier. Is that correct, Melissa?
I should put a little bit of clarity on that. We have reached a settlement specifically around the energy issues that were under review at the Maine Public Utilities Commission. But there are still issues under review at other agencies, including the Maine Department of Environmental Protection. And so unlike in New Hampshire, where there's really a one-stop shop for permitting for the site and construction permit that a project developer needs, we have here in New Hampshire, we have that site evaluation committee. That's a one-stop shop, kind of bundle things together. In Maine, they do things a little bit differently. Every state does things a little bit differently. In Maine, they have a couple of different processes. And at the Public Utilities Commission, we reached a settlement to support some of the terms that are put forward there. And NECEC specifically put forward a number of energy terms that were great, including a fund for heat pumps, an electric vehicle fund, agreeing to push forward innovative energy solutions like non-wires alternatives, and agreeing to work with stakeholders on decarbonization. This is a huge issue in the region. Decarbonization to address climate change, right? Now, at the Department of Environmental Protection, the CLF actually has major concerns and has gone on the record saying that without additional mitigating conditions, the environmental permit shouldn't be issued.
Oh, so it's not correct then. And I was just looking at some of the main, you know, the press in Maine this morning and yesterday. So it's not entirely correct, Melissa, to say that CLF supports the Maine project while it opposed the Northern Pass project in New Hampshire.
That's right. It's more subtle than that. As I said, here in New Hampshire, the SEC bundled everything together. In Maine, it's a little bit different. There's some separate permitting processes, and we've supported the project in some of those processes, and we're still questioning it in other processes. We believe that any large hydro and large transmission project needs to appropriately mitigate its impacts, and we want to see more of that before we could support a project like the NECEC project in Maine.
And again, NECEC is, just remind us what that is since we're here in New Hampshire.
That is the New England Clean Energy Connect project, which would go through Maine,
gotcha.
The 150-mile line project through Maine.
So hydro itself, it sounds like, and please correct me if I'm wrong, Melissa, hydro itself, you've got some concerns about whether it's actually clean. For example, concerning Northern Pass, you said that tapping Hydro-Québec's electricity, quote, makes us reliant on big carbon-emitting Canadian hydropower, undermining the market for New England's own homegrown zero-carbon renewable energy. So in terms of Northern Pass, it's not perfect. In terms of Maine, not perfect either, but Maine is taking more mitigating, greenhouse gas mitigating efforts towards this project. Is that, have I got that right?
Look, climate change is a huge threat to the country, to the world, to the region, and we have to reduce our carbon impact, particularly in our energy resources and our transportation. So when you look at hydroelectric power, you have to be honest that it's not perfect for the climate. There are methane emissions that are significant in some cases, very significant in other cases. And Hydro-Québec, you know, the fact that they didn't participate here in New Hampshire in the siting process gave us a lack of transparency into what their real impacts were. It was a real hurdle to get around the fact that Eversource wasn't being forthright and we didn't have Hydro-Québec there to talk to and to get at some of these issues. But hydroelectric power is not without impacts. It's not without greenhouse gas impacts. It's not without impacts on the habitat and the environment. The other thing that we have to be careful about is impacts on local and indigenous communities.
And Sam talked about that in his series Powerline. I have to wrap you up, Melissa, and I do apologize. So, but just to very quickly summarize, so it sounds like You've got some serious concerns about hydro, but you're not going to be opposed in every instance.
We believe that hydroelectric power does play a role. We'd like to see a strong emphasis on the development of offshore wind in the region, on the development of solar and wind plus storage to avoid fossil fuel plants. But we also believe that hydroelectric power can play an important role in that decarbonization process that we all need to get on board with.
Okay. Melissa, I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Melissa Burchard, Senior Attorney for the Conservation Law Foundation. You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, the defeat of the Northern Pass Hydropower Project, what happened and what it means for other hydro proposals around New England. Let's hear from you. Call in 1-800-892-6477 or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. I'm talking with John Dankosky. He's executive editor of the New England News Collaborative, host of Next, a weekly radio show and podcast about New England, produced by Connecticut Public Radio in Hartford, where he joins us. And Sam Evans-Brown is with us in studio, host of NHPR's podcast, Outside In. And both of you, John, first, we talked about New Hampshire a lot, obviously. We've talked about Vermont. We've talked about Maine. I'd like to, John, talk a little bit more about Massachusetts. How much do you see, John, Massachusetts really driving this alternative energy train here in New England?
Well, Massachusetts has been trying to procure more renewable energy over the course of the last couple of years. Governor Charlie Baker has been very strongly behind that move. They've partnered with Connecticut and Rhode Island on a couple of projects so far, and they've also made this request for hydropower from Quebec that led us down the road of whether or not we're going to take that power from Northern Pass or from Maine. I think the other thing is that they very well could be the next leaders in wind power. Offshore wind, and I think Sam knows this better than just about anybody, is the next great frontier for renewable energy in America. There isn't any here in the States. There's one very small wind farm off of Block Island in Rhode Island, and that's about it. But in the next couple of years, we're going to see a big Vineyard wind project off of Martha's Vineyard, and we're going to see more and more power, much of it being procured by the folks in Boston and Massachusetts, and some of it being situated right off their coastline as well. The days of the Cape Wind project facing so much opposition, in large part because of the way that it was rolled out, I think those days are past, and I think it's fair to say that Massachusetts is already a leader in clean energy in the nation, and they're going to just be hungry for more in the next decade or so.
Well, and speaking of hydropower in Massachusetts, Sam, I found it surprising, I don't know, 2 or 3 years ago when Massachusetts said, hey, as part of our meeting our clean energy goals, we're going to be buying power from Northern Pass. And here in New Hampshire, big front page, Boston Globe. And I remember thinking, wait, that hasn't been approved yet. So why did Massachusetts sort of check that box off when it was not checked off here in the Granite State?
Well, so I mean, they essentially, because of the way the law was written, they had to pick a project before any project was approved.
I see.
And at the time, Northern Pass was the project that was furthest along in the development cycle. That's not quite true. There was one project that had its permits. It was a project that would have gone underwater through Vermont and then underground over to the town where the old nuclear plant had just gone offline. But that project was very expensive, and so Massachusetts didn't choose that one because it was too much money to build it. So essentially, the way their process was laid out, they were picking between, there were actually 64 different projects that submitted to that whole thing. Five of them were power lines. There were five competing power lines, including Northern Pass, and Northern Pass won the bid. But essentially, they got the cart before the horse, right? They thought that this project was going to get approved, but there was a provision in the law that if it didn't get approved, they were able to go back and choose backups, which is what they wound up doing. I mean, but the thing that's really interesting to me about the Massachusetts connection is that when you look at the development cycle of Northern Pass, it first started in the late aughts. So 2008, Ian Bowles, who was the head of the environmental department in Massachusetts, had a meeting with Hydro-Québec and higher-ups at Eversource, and they said, hey, you want to reduce your carbon emissions? We've got a project for you. So even before this law that actually officially purchased and signed a contract with Hydro-Québec was passed, this was a project that was intended to satisfy the policy goals of Massachusetts. At the time, it was something called the Global Warming Solutions Act that mandated that Massachusetts lower its greenhouse gas emissions by 2025. And so I might have that year wrong. John can correct me. but essentially, this has been a project that's been aimed at Massachusetts since the beginning.
So it's really interesting. So Massachusetts has these very clear goals. They seem committed to them. They seem to want to include HydroSam to reach those goals, but the hydro has to go through
somewhere.
Maine or New Hampshire or Vermont. And this kind of sets up this whole sort of north-south tension again that John mentioned. It's very interesting.
And that's why the law that was passed that created this competitive solicitation process for a project was established, is that Massachusetts started to realize that if we want one of these projects to get built, we're going to have to pay for it. And so when it became clear that Northern Pass was on the rocks, that's when that law was passed. They're saying maybe we could give it a prod to get it across the finish line.
Here's an email that came in from Wes in Deerfield, who says, living in Deerfield and seeing the local potential impact, I was not for Northern Pass. Wes says, however, I do agree with the tree hugger comments broadcast earlier from our caller, Tim. This discussion brings up a much bigger issue than the hydropower in New England. We have the potential, Wes says, for generating electricity in equatorial regions and transporting it to energy-poor regions, but we need the transportation lines for the energy. We need to get past NIMBY. Wes says, I think we should develop some kind of apples-to-apples system so we can compare the impact of energy projects with, for example, blowing the top off a mountain. That seems to be a reference to coal. There needs to be public inclusion, Wes says, in a real way, and transmission lines can't necessarily be the cheapest, straightest route. Wes, thank you so much. And this brings up something. John, I'll turn to you. Critics of Northern Pass said, look, these big, sort of hulking, old-fashioned, giant projects with big, obvious transmission lines are outdated. This is not where people are going nowadays. So, you know, goodbye to that type of project. What do you think?
Well, I think what's interesting, when we hear the tree hugger comments, we hear about the reasons why people might oppose something like this. It really does, unfortunately, to the person who wrote in, it really does get down to backyard issues. Your earlier caller talked about the tensions between environmentalists around all sorts of renewable sources of energy. People want to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. They don't want to necessarily have the thing that does that in their backyard. In Connecticut, where I live, there are only two wind turbines in the entire state, and it's unlikely that while I am alive, any more get put up because people just don't really want to see them. They don't want them anywhere near their backyard. Solar arrays have some of the same problem, and big, long-throw transmission lines coming down from Canada definitely have those issues, especially when they come through states that are environmentally sensitive like yours and places where people are making money off of natural beauty. I did want to pick up, though, on something that we heard earlier. This idea of decarbonization as part of the overall plan that could come forward through the CMP, the Central Maine Power Project, they put a lot of money into this, and they basically were olive branches to the environmentalists. $15 million to subsidize residential heat pump purchases. That'll drive down overall energy consumption. $15 million for electric vehicle charging station networks and rebates for electric car purchases, and also money that would go into improving transmission interconnections, which hopefully would mean more headroom on the grid. Those are some ways that projects like this can reach out, I think, to some of the folks who have concerns for very good environmental reasons and say, we want to make sure that there's renewable energy here, and we want to help do some other things that you might care about at the same time.
Well, and that's a perfect segue for my last question for you, Sam. Eversource has said it may reapply for another transmission project in New Hampshire. Just relating to what John just said, how might Eversource approach the process differently if it goes for it again, given what happened with Northern Pass?
Well, so as a threshold question, they can't just take the same project and submit the same application again. We saw that with the Antrim Wind Farm in New Hampshire. There has to be some sort of change to the plan if they want to resubmit it. You know, this project's been denied. You have to change it. The question of how much do you have to change it is an open one. You know, Antrim Wind eliminated a single wind turbine and made another one shorter, and that was enough for it to resubmit and get approved. So it could be relatively minor changes for them to resubmit the application. I think that if they made relatively minor changes and resubmitted, they would have a world of opposition that they'd be facing again. There was another project proposed in New Hampshire through the whole Massachusetts RFP process that by National Grid, a competitor to Eversource. So New Hampshire actually already has an HVDC power line that is very similar to what Northern Pass would look like. It was built.
So it has the infrastructure.
Well, yeah. Well, so it's got one of these already. It was built in the late 1980s in response to the Arab oil embargoes and the oil crunch that resulted from that. And it goes all the way up to the James Bay in Quebec. It's over 2,000 miles long, and it goes like 3 miles from my house. And National Grid proposed moving that power line over a little bit and putting another one next to it, which I think you'd see a radically different response to a project like that. So the question is, if Eversource changes their project, how much will they change it, and will it undermine the opposition?
Well, there's a lot more we could have talked about, so we'll have to revisit this again. John, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Happy to do it.
And Sam Evans Brown, thank you again.
Thank you, Laura.
And be sure to check out Sam's award-winning series on hydropower called Powerline on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.